कृष्णाय कृष्ण भक्ताय तद्भक्ताय नमो नमः। सो प्रणाम टू ऑल ऑफ यू एंड वेलकम। थैंक यू सो मच फॉर एंटरिंग येट अनदर सेक्रेट सर्कल विद ऑल ऑफ अस इन तदात्म्य संघ in a community of empathy, in this, whether we call it devotional alliance, whether we call it, as the other day I was talking with the rabbi, he will call it house of exploration, whether we call it school of love, as we also thought about at one point, all those names and more than that, that's what we are trying to be part and to invoke today. So it's because of your presence that this is possible. Each of you is a crucial piece of the puzzle. So thank you so much for investing your time, your presence, your life, your will in choosing to be here today. And of course, my affectionate greetings from Sweden. And here I am visiting Sadhananda Swami's realm, let's put it that way. Some of the followers of Sri Sadananda Swami, who was one of the, well, the main, the first Western disciple of Prabhupada Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur from Germany, and different followers of him, disciples of his disciples, are living in this area in Sweden. Some others are living in other parts in Germany and have come here. So last year I came. First time here, this is the second time, and it's been a very fruitful experience of sharing every day, walks, readings, back and forth. So this has been a very nourishing journey so far, especially, yeah, for me it's always a beautiful adventure and a very, not, I won't say challenging, because fortunately it doesn't feel like a challenge, but it still is, feels like a very healthy exercise of adaptation. The fact of visiting different Vaishnav, Gaudiya Vaishnav Sanghas communities, each one with their own mood, flavor, ways of doing things, which are different from other places, how they do things, and being able to witness the genuineness and bona fideness, so to say, in that diversity. And keeping that idea very clear in mind that there is not only one single way of doing things and legally, correctly, but there are more than one. Of course, with this, I'm not saying you can do anything and everything, and that's fine. But there are more than one way of doing things correctly, so to say, of living your life, of addressing your relationship with Krishna. Ultimately, each one of us have to find our own unique, specific, individuated way of doing so. So ultimately, it's very precise, very specific, very unique. But for me, witnessing this diversity in the different places that I am able to visit is like a very nice appetizer and trailer of the diversity and the uniqueness that ultimately each one of us have to offer and present for the pleasure of Bhagavan. So here we are, and for a few more days till Tuesday, then traveling to France. So probably next meeting will be from there, from Dijon. So anyhow, and here we are with all of you, which is very, very blessed for me to have this weekly shelter, and this weekly nourishing, divine blood transfusion, infusion in Sangha. So that said, let's begin. Let's begin. If you have any questions, if you have any comments, if you have anything you may like to share in whatever direction. So I see a few hands already raised. So we will start with Karuneshwar is the first one. So you can unmute yourself, please.
Hare Krishna Maharaj. So my question is not just my question. We had a meeting with some of our UK Sangha group last night. And so it's from myself, Anuradha, Yogamaya, Sam, and
And probably
So
many, many more of us as well.
now,
Let's see.
so we were talking about how some of us had heard, again, we're going to mention Richard Rohr, but not only Richard Rohr, but some of us had heard him in one lecture, and Schwetterdweep was another person. So some of us had heard him in one lecture talking about how he believes that people can be a saint at any level of human consciousness, from like the least evolved state of your human evolution right up to the higher, but he felt you could be a saint at any one of those stages. And then we went from there to looking at the Madhurya Kadambini. And so I have it here, this one sentence I'd like to read out, where it's where Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur is saying, by the presence or absence of steadiness in bhakti itself, rather than in the qualities of bhakti, learned wise men understand the actual presence or absence of nishtha. So pretty much saying it's the steadiness in bhakti rather than the person's qualities that determine whether you're at nishtha or not. So then we went on from both those points, from Richard Rohr and Madhurya Kadambini, to a discussion about, how could that work, that someone, is it that someone can have some level of spiritual advancement while at the same time on the human, emotional, state being quite unevolved? And we had a bit of a discussion, and we talked about some people that we know who look very, very fixed in their practice, but at the same time, they might be for many years suffering from anxiety or depression and being very unhappy on some level, while at the same time being very fixed in their service. And so we couldn't really answer it, so we thought we'd bring it to you.
I was just about to ask you, so which was the conclusion you saw together? So yeah, let's see where we get saying something, thinking about these important themes. So a few things come to mind. First, you're referring to Richard Rohr saying that one can be a saintly person and every on any stage of the journey. And of course, that naturally, of course, what does it mean saintly? Some people will use the word to mean one thing. Some people will over conceive, so to say, the term. Not like they will use saintly only to refer to topmost liberated, eternally associates of Bhagavan, which I remember when we were in New Jersey. As you may recall, we gave a lecture on what Sadhu Sangha. So I asked the devotees, so what does the term sadhu invoke? What do you think when you hear the word sadhu? Who is the sadhu? So very quickly they came, okay, sadhu, saintly person. What else? And every time I asked, the standard became higher and higher. Now sadhu is saintly, high, sadhu is pure devotee, sadhu is prema bhakta, sadhu is nityasiddha, eternal associate. It was like, whoa, okay. And of course, I don't deny all of them are sadhus. That's an important thing. All the way up, all that is sadhu. But also, all the way down, the word sadhu can also be applied. And that's what makes me think of what Richard was saying in connection to Bhagavad Gita, that verse number 30 in ninth chapter, where Krishna is saying, Apichet sudurachero bhajante Sadureva samantavya samyabhyabhyasito hisa. So in this verse, Krishna is speaking about the form of saintliness, and also he's speaking about the form of nishtha or fixity. Again, every time we can use saintly to refer to something, to some other thing, we can use the word nishtha to refer as to a specific stage in the process of bhakti, or we can also use nishtha as to some determined conviction. Whatever stage I am, no, that's also another way of speaking about that. So, in this verse of the Gita 9:30, as you may know, Krishna says, "Apichet sudurachero bhajante." Even if you behave very badly, sudurachar. So he's not talking definitely about the topmost Mahabhagavat Nityasiddha with the best behavior, but someone who really behaves still in a bad way, let's say, engages in unbecoming, undesirable stuff, has its ups and his her ups and downs and so on. But is exclusively determining worshipping me, Nishta, a type of fixity of determination. No matter how disastrous my present situation is, how unstable, I have this determination. Among all this lack of stability, I'm determined in this direction. I will try to be determining I will try to sincerely surrender, give myself to Krishna. To be honest, to try to engage in surrender, no matter how many times I fail, to trust in his love, unconditional love and shelter, the mercy of the saintly people. And that person becomes saintly, Krishna says. That's an interesting point. He says, Sadureva Samantabhyasam Yabhyabhyasito Isaha. So he's Vyabhyasita, he's Samyak Vyabhyasita, he's properly situated in his determination, Nishta. Again, his determination being not so much being, I will never fail, because the person may still fail miserably. The person that her determination is, I'll try to please Krishna, I'll try to give myself to him as I am. That's how also bhakti comes to our life, no? And this is an important point. Bhakti doesn't wait for us to be pure, so to say, to come to our lives, but comes to our lives, and that's how we become pure. That's it, the unconditionality of bhakti. Bhakti is unconditional. Ahai tu kiya pratihata. So it doesn't care for our external condition, purity, high birth, low birth, mental stability, instability. But if we have shraddha, if we have faith, proper faith in the divine message, in revelation, in Guru Shastra and Sadhu, if we have that openness of heart based on proper experience, that's basically what qualifies us to thread the path, in brief words. So again, in this verse of the Gita, Krishna is describing someone of not very good behavior as saintly, using the word sadhu. Basically, sadhu is synonym with saintly. That's the most famous verse of the Gita where Krishna speaks about saintly, where he uses the word sadhu. And he uses in relation to someone who is not in nishtha as a stage in bhakti, which basically means that you are considerably beyond anarthas, but he or she is in nishtha in terms of his determination and seriousness and honesty and integrity to not abandon the path, to not compromise the ideals. As much as one may keep failing miserably in one's attempt to go deeper into that, but the determination remains there. So that's a particular combination that touches Krishna's heart very much. Like, oh, you fail miserably, and you do not never leave, never give up. You continue, you try again. You fall and you rise again, and you continue to try with lots of trust and humility. Every time you fall, you become more humble, more sincere. So how much you can call it a fall, of course. And Krishna becomes charmed by that, to the point that he considers that person my sadhu. And so that's what I will say in this connection. So that's a good point in terms of what you mentioned after. We have to be very careful in judging other people, because we may judge people according to, again, as we say many times, the level of performance. No? Someone be performing perfectly externally. You can be, and whatever that means, no? Because everyone has their own idea of what it means to perform perfectly devotional service. Of course, if you are realistic and humble enough, first you won't be willing to perform, and you know that it's not possible to do it perfectly. It can always be more perfect. And we are not here after perfection in the sense of some ego price. No? Now I did it perfectly. So what does it mean, right? So again, the point is that someone may perform perfectly in the sense of what some understand as performing perfectly, following the four regulative principles perfectly, chanting the 16 rounds perfectly in number, again, right? In external form, following the rules, the numbers, the rituals, the protocol, all the legal do's and don'ts externally are there. But probably internally, you can just become, you may have become just complacent because of the fact that you think that you are doing everything perfectly. So you are already saved and nobody can tell you anything. And you are there to tell everyone else what to do and so many things. And you create all these layers of spiritual bypassing and evasiveness that through which nobody can tell you anything, not even yourself, not even Krishna, your heart. There's nothing to improve or to change because you are performing perfectly. But you are not increasing your sincerity, your longing, your honesty, your depth, no, your healthy desperation to grow in relationship with God. You become stagnant, complacent, status quo, Maya. And on the other side, you have someone who, for whatever reason, is failing. No, it's not able to follow certain rules. It's breaking all the vows and rules that the other person is following perfectly. But that takes this person to become more humble, more sincere, to pray more fervently for shelter, to be more and more aware of one's own frailty and brokenness, and from that place remain in a vulnerable place, open to nourishing. So the real question is, who is more advanced of those two? Who is closer to Krishna? Who is pleasing Krishna's heart the most? So again, Krishna never says in scripture, you will please me more by performing perfectly. Over and over again, he will say, you will please me more by your inner attitude, no? Your inner dignity, your inner honesty. That's what pleases me the most. Despite the external circumstance, despite success or failure, and though both will come back and forth. So Krishna said, I don't care for that. If externally you are very successful or you are not very successful, I don't care for that in the sense that the mere success or the mere failure is not what pleases me. I want to see your voluntary investment of your will, of your agency, of your heart to me. I want a personal relationship. I'm a person, you're a person. Let's have a radically personal relationship. If that's not the case, that's basically impersonalism. So we may be trying to please God with some impersonal performance. Again, offering of numbers, offering of facade, huh? Trying to convince Krishna that we are well, good boys, good girls, deserving of his grace or anything. And Krishna is like, you didn't get me at all. You don't have a clue who I am. Now you are projecting all your biases and assumptions and filters and prejudices and unresolved trauma, and you are making me an object of that, basically. You are seeing me through all those filters. So what remains of Krishna when we approach the divine through all those filters? Almost nothing. Although we may be convinced that's God. So yeah, that's what I will say. What Richard says, you can be saintly in any moment. For me, means this idea of saintliness. For us, means sadhu. Sadhu has to do with sat, which means truth, which means honesty. So no matter which stage of the journey you are, saintliness means to be as utterly honest as you can to acknowledge where you are, where you want to be, and what's required in between. And trying your best to do it. That saintliness in that particular stage. Again, that's what Krishna says in Gita 9:30. We are not here making up any new theory. So, but it's interesting, again, you're quoting Richard Rohr, so someone who probably never read that verse. But intuitively, so to say, we reach similar conclusions. Now, there is the possibility of being saintly in this way. No, it's being as sincere as you can, no matter what stage you are in. What's the corresponding expression of saintlyhood to the particular chapter you're in? Again, there has to be a corresponding expression of that for every stage of the journey. It's not so much saintliness means once you are on the level of Rupa Goswami, once you become, that's a more, yeah, elitist way of speaking about saintliness, more exclusive instead of ex inclusive and inviting, because the more we push saintliness to the clouds, so to say, the more we receive the message that that's not for me. So I don't have to strive to be saintly at this precise moment. And that prevents me from asking myself, what does it mean to be saintly in the stage I am? And I end up not being as sincere as I can for this stage, as saintly as I can. That's saintly. Again, saintly is not a label and a price I want to attain to become famous as such. Right? So that's another thing. What do we think when we hear saintly? Or when we hear the word saintly in relationship to us? How does it fit? Do we see it as a, again, as a label we want to attain, and that will give us some whatever, or mostly as the natural sincerity that should be there at every step of the journey, right? So I think that's a more user-friendly way of speaking about that. And in the same way, we can speak about Nishtha in that same way. In one sense, Nishtha can be seen as a stage that is for most of the sadhakas, the stage, the ideal stage to reach, no? When there is more balance and stability and integration and wholeness, I will say, of all the layers of our existence, spiritual, of course, but also human, mental, emotional, physical, all that can be in a holistic way integrated into the bhakti project. So that's a nice wholesome balance, and we can call that nishtha. But also, again, nishtha can mean in the midst of all my turmoil and all my ups and downs before nishtha's stage, I will express some form of nishtha in terms of my sankalpa, my intention. Like, try to develop some unwavering intention. Like, no matter what happens, I don't want to betray myself. Don't want to betray myself. I have some ideal. By the grace of God, I have seen certain things. I know on some level how reality operates, what's actually going on. So I don't want to deny that, to live as if that does not exist. I want to embrace that nishtha. I want to commit myself to not betray such a gift, such an epiphany that came to my life. Even when I'm failing miserably, that's what the Bhagavatam says in the 11th canto. In the 11th canto says, I'll go straight to the translation. It says, in the staying before nishtha, you may be ups and downs, and you may fail. You may still have desires, and you may have certain knowledge of certain things that are not conducive for you, but still you keep indulging in them. So what the Bhagavatam says, every time you fall into that, let's use that word, if you will, what should you do? You should repent sincerely, rise up, and try it again. That's it. Don't make a big drama out of that. No? Don't make like a three-year drama period because of your last falling down, and everyone gets to know about all that, and it's a whole Netflix series. No, no, wake up and continue, and shoot again, as we will say. No, hamartia in Greek means sin, missing the mark. It's an archery term. You miss the mark. No? What we call sometimes fall down, which for me is a very loaded term, which I prefer not to use because of all the generational associations tied to that. And sometimes it's like saying apparati. It's kind of like you brand someone with some label that then is impossible to take out. So you fell down, you broke a principle, you engage in sin. I'm not promoting that. I'm just saying that may happen. Let's be realistic. You missed the mark. That's the point. We are trying to hit the mark, to aim properly to the center of reality. We missed the mark. What you do, take the bow and the arrow again, shoot again. Oh, I missed the mark again. Shoot again. There are unlimited arrows and unlimited bows, no problem. As long as you have that willingness, that nishtha, keep trying. So that's the nishtha we are talking about here. You can have the nishtha from day one, no matter how disastrous you are. And especially that, when we are in a very still unstable situation, self-contradictory, and all this messy humanness. And despite that, in the context of that, we receive love, support, unconditional nourishing from the divine, from Sangha. I mean, that's naturally will create in us some nishtha, some will, some desire to, I want to commit to these people, I want to commit to this ideal, because no matter how hard I fail, the shelter remains open. The more I fail, the more the shelter extends to me. So I want to commit myself here naturally. It comes naturally. I'm purchased in this direction. They have conquered me. So that's the natural niche that has to happen if we are in proper environment. And that takes us to this natural saintliness of being honest and sincere, not only in trying again, but also honest and sincere in every time I fail again. Now, both honesties are required. Now, both forms of saintliness. Not only I do it, because sometimes again we associate saintliness with performing perfectly. But no, saintliness means Sanskrit sadhutva, which means utterly honest. So you have to be utterly honest in your wish to continue aiming and trying, but also you have to be utterly honest in acknowledging you're missing the mark with vulnerability, with humility. And both are faces of saintliness, right? Because if not, if we get only one side of the coin of saintliness, we just take saintliness out of context and think it's just a mask and it's about performing perfectly, and we put it too high, and nobody ends up being a saint of in any form. And we just get discouraged, and we just keep creating this abyss between those who are saintly and everyone else. And I've seen that a lot in our community with love and respect and constructive criticism, but many times we draw a very hard line between those who are saintly and pure devotees and everyone else. No? There's not much in between spaces, so to say. While I think it's way more healthy to start to speak in another way, like we are doing now, like everyone can be saintly. There's a corresponding saintliness to whatever, to each stage you're in. Everyone can be nishtha. There is a corresponding fixity and determination from wherever you are. And from wherever you are, you attain the corresponding saintliness and fixity. And from that, you continue growing. That's why the Bhagavatam says, Swesva adhikari janishtha saguna parikirtita. To establish your own adhikar is real virtue and real beauty. In other words, to know where you are is the highest virtue, as simple as that sounds. To know where you are, not trying to imitate, not think you are higher than you are, not think you are lower than you are, to know where you are, and of course it implies an acting accordingly, as we are talking now, and finding your corresponding form of saintliness, your corresponding form of nishtha, according to where you are, that's real virtue. And to not do that, the Bhagavatam say, that's impiety. That's a form of sin, if you want to put it that way. No? To not be willing to acknowledge where you are and insist on something that you are not, that's a form of sin. Because sometimes we also translate sin with like some sinful activity, so to say, right? I'm not saying that's not sin. I'm just saying there are other ways of sin also. When you refuse to grow, that's a sin. So to say, when you deny where you are, that's sinful. When you try to force yourself upon you at a stage that you are not in yet, or you have already been, but it's no longer the moment for you to remain there, all those are varieties of sin because you are resisting reality, resisting, denying reality. So, anyhow, some words in connection to this, and hopefully, yeah, we get it. A new language to relate to all the things in a way that is really realistic, sustainable. So I hope that helps,
Yeah,
Karuneshwari.
that's great. Thank you. And
Okay.
yeah.
Thank you. Thank you for your question. Okay. Who else? Maheshwar Prabhu from UK.
Hare Krishna Maharaj. Maybe this sort of interlinked to what you've just been talking about knowing where you are and where you stand, but I want to connect it to vulnerability. And where you talk about vulnerability is standing naked in front of Krishna, emotionally broken with your brokenness and everything. And with that often comes the anxiety, the depression, the tears. And you know, I love the idea of having that vulnerability and standing in front of the deities and expressing yourself as you are in the present moment. But then we read things like there's an offense against the deity is to cry in front of the deities. So I just wanted to see the paradox between the two and see your sort of thoughts behind it. So for me, the vulnerability and the brokenness is where we need to start. But then there's, and I know there's different types of crying. We talk about, you know, Gaugavindaswamy talks about crying skull for Krishna and things like that. So there's different levels of it. But you know, with the brokenness, you know, more from the mental sort of health side of things, you know, to sit in front of deities and express yourself in the present moment as you are, is that an offense?
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. I now that you say it, I kind of probably remember that I read it years ago, no, this long list of seva apparat, so to say, and one of them being crying in front of the deity. I forgot about that one. Thanks for bringing that up. And in relation to your question, to be honest, I don't know. I don't know. I don't know how to explain that apparat because for me, it doesn't make sense that you shouldn't cry in front of deity. Now, of course, again, I can, if you want to call it speculate, or trying to explain that in ways that probably make sense, and we can do further research. Again, I don't want to give any final word here, but probably the don't cry in front of the deity could be just don't limit yourself to cry in front of the deity, so to say, but also offer some service and provide some be willing to give and to offer something, although there is time for crying. Again, that's my own explanation, how it will make sense to me, because if not, it sounds a little bit restrictive. No, it kind of promotes performance. Again, don't cry in front of Krishna. Not just again, what's the deity? You know, the deity is Krishna, right? So Krishna is omniscient, basically, in general, omnipresent. So he knows what's going on with us. So it's not like, okay, I'm crying. I cannot cry in front of the deity, but I'll go to my house and cry there. Like, the same deity is Krishna, and he's seeing you crying, right? So what I will say is more, the crying is, I will say, no, don't bring Krishna, a type of crying, as you mentioned. That's the first thing that came to me, what you were saying about there are types of tears. I remember also we gave a lecture some time ago of on different types of tears. No, the tears of like material lamentation out of material attachment and delusion. Although there are tears in that realm, so to say, there are tears out of sincere repentance, like we were talking a few minutes ago, coming from a sincere sadhaka, and there are tears of ecstatic emotion, so to say. And of course, there are so many in between. I'm just summarizing them in three categories. So I will say that this list, this particular offense of don't cry in front of the deity will be more don't cry for material things to Krishna. Like don't go to the deity just with your long list of things, whether that you had and lost and you want them back, and that don't go to Krishna again like a provider and give me this, I'm crying, give me, I want, I need, give me from a self-centered perspective. That's not a healthy approach to God, basically, because again, going to the deity means approaching your relationship with Krishna. So don't approach your relationship with Krishna with a long list of tears that come from that place. Although at the same time, again, I'm saying that, and I'm saying, let's see in there. I'm seeing there are five comments. Sorry, I'm not reading anything what you're mentioning. I'll go back there. Okay, they are putting some comments. Prana saying, don't cry for material things. Balaram Shakti saying, my understanding of those apparats is the underlying thread of them is no mundane activity in front of the deity, such as gossiping or glorifying anyone other than the deity. So I think the Goswamis are referring to mundane crying. Yeah, okay. Yeah, of course. So I will say that if we as a sadhaka, as a practitioner, as you were mentioning, Maheshwar, we may have our moments of emotional breakdown or some particular situation we are going in our human experience as sadhakas, I wouldn't say don't show the deity those tears, so to say. No, if they come naturally, if that's something in which you feel supported, loved, received, heard, and there's of course a reciprocation, why not to do that? So I will say the main theme is don't see the deity just merely as someone who is there to provide what you want and whenever you want, however you want, because many people approach the deity from that place. No? I wouldn't say ideally Vaishnavas, although there are different levels of Vaishnava. But if you go to India, how many people do not go to the deity or to an altar just looking for material blessings, think for them, think for, and just like a formulaic thing, no? Like what Bhakti Rasa was talking some weeks ago or days ago, like magic, no? Okay, I go in front of the deity, I offer this banana with this donation that this panda told me to do, I repeat this mantra, and I will have the car that I always wanted, or I will get married with the lady of my dreams. Eh? And God becomes for you just like a mechanical provider, basically. So I will say that's the main spirit. And even saying that, of course, we know that Krishna, the Bhagavad Gita, says Chatur Bhidava. He speaks about four people who approach him, and he uses the word Artha Jignasu Jnani Chavaratarsava. One of them is the afflicted one, another one is the one who looks for some wealth. So at the same time, Krishna is generous, but at the same time, like he says in the Bhagavatam, when someone asks me a blessing, I satisfy that request, but in such a way that the person is not over and over again requesting the same thing. No, like, okay, you are a devotee, you have some material need, call it material. You don't have where to live, what to eat. You need some basic stability to practice to be a better devotee. Okay, Krishna say, I provide that. But don't come again and ask me a bigger house, more fancy car, and more and more and more. It doesn't work like that. No. So there has to be this like ethic in the parameters of our approach and request. And to understand that, yeah, approaching God is not just purely in terms of requesting or requesting things or even requesting relief. Because again, you can go with your tears, which come out of material attachment and misery. And it's okay, but the point is, are you willing to change? Or you are just suffering miserably and you are just want relief, so you continue doing the same thing without changing. That's not favorable. That's what these rules for me are recommending. Do not do that. No, because that happens a lot also. And of course, if it's from the proper place, as Bhakti Rasa says, I'm seeing as she's writing, tears can be an offering. No? So through tears, you can please Bhagavan. You can offer your tears. You can offer the water of your sadaka deha in that particular form. If it comes again from a place of saintliness, from a place of sincerity, as there is a corresponding saintliness for every stage of your journey, we could say there is a corresponding set of tears for every chapter of your life. There's always something you could be crying about wherever you are, in whatever stage you are. So you need to become aware of that. You need to contact those tears and cry them. No? Whether it comes out outwardly as water, or sometimes it's an inner crying. Also, knows. Sometimes it will be accompanied by water, sometimes it may not. So yeah, I will personally understand that in that way and explain it that way, because if not, it will be contradictory to so many other things that are being said throughout the scriptures and even in some of those lists. So we always have to reconcile and understand everything in a way that keeps like overall coherence, so to say, right? So, yeah, Krishna is welcoming our tears, our sincerity at every stage of the journey, for sure. Yeah. Thank you, Maheshwar. I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, it does make sense. It's beautiful. And it also made me think of Arjuna on the battlefield as you were talking and his willingness to change. So the breakdown at the beginning and then the willing to change and listen to Krishna as guru. Yeah.
And no wonder that's the first chapter of the Gita, right? The very first chapter called Vishada Yoga, which means the yoga of despair. If you wanted to call it more poetically, you can call it the yoga of tears. No? So Arjuna is, as you say, broken, throwing the arrow bow on the floor. And Krishna is not saying, hey, you cannot cry in front of me. That's offensive. He's not saying that. No. So he's addressing that. But Arjuna, the most important point that you mentioned is he's willing to change. No, he's willing to hear. He's willing to be transformed. Because if not, we can use tears as an armor not to change. We can become professional criers, so to say. So whenever I need to change something, I start to cry. So I try to evoke pity in the environment. So nobody can tell me anything at that moment, no? Because I start crying miserably. So nobody will tell me, you should be changing, not crying, no? So everyone will be, oh, you're crying, poor. It can happen. No, we can develop that type of defense mechanism. No, so we invoke a set of tears to avoid another set of tears. No? So we avoid crying by crying, something like that. So again, that particular rule that you refer is preventing a certain type of crying, not all type of crying, basically, right? So yeah, Badr is saying a trait learned in childhood. Exactly. Now we can become very good vaisyas through tears, no? To get what we want, when to cry, when not to cry, or when to anything, when to get angry, when to invoke particular emotional dispositions to manipulate the environment instead of dedicating ourselves as a unit of service. So it's all about from which place the tears are coming or whatever is coming. Thank you. We'll go to the next question, which is Balaram Shakti raising his hand? I don't know if you can unmute yourself.
Yes, Hare Krishna.
Nice to hear
It's
you.
nice timing as I just got pulled into a weigh station, so I'm going to park here.
You are driving a big truck, so be careful.
Yes. Yeah, I'm able to park before I go back on the Yeah, thank you all so much. I got a lot out of the last few, these first two questions. And I think they relate a lot to what I had asked. And hold on, I'm just parking now so I can focus.
No problem. We are there with you. Look
Okay.
in the rear view mirror just in case.
Jai. Yeah, so I had sent you an email, gosh, a few weeks ago, and you had recommended that we bring it up to the chat. And it was on this idea of contradiction, and I thought that the Apcha Sudarataro, the concept of a sadhu, really helped illuminate this a little bit. I was reminded of I have a lot to say on this. I'll try to say succinct. That Krishna says, I forget where, sometimes the living entity takes birth in this body, sometimes as a saintly person, and it's like, oh, that's a type of body. It's like a temporary situation. So that was interesting. I was reminded as well, the virtue over morality. I believe Richard Rohr was spoke on that. The real virtue, like what virtue means. It's not this moral sense of like always doing the right thing or being perfect, but rather when you do experience imperfection that you're able to get up, as you're saying, and like keep going. And I read also a couple weeks ago from Suzuki Roshi, the master Zazen teacher. Amazing, amazing speaker and personality. He had this writing on the marrow of Zen, the marrow of Zen, and he told this story, and it's amazing because it's like a parable, if you will, take on our teaching of the four types of intelligence, like one who learns by hearing, one who learns by seeing. You know, as soon as someone hears something, or is, if they have to see it or they have to experience it themselves, then they don't touch the fire again, or they keep touching the fire and they never learn. So he gave it in this story of a horse. There's four types of horses. You know, one who starts to run before he sees the shadow of the whip, one who starts to run once he sees the shadow, one who starts to run once he's hit by the whip, and the fourth type of horse is one who starts to run when the whip, you know, digs down into the marrow of his bones. And I was like, whoa, that's me. Like, what is it going to take? You know, I'm going to, like, I need it to run so deep. You know, so, but he added something amazing that he said, actually, the first type of intelligence isn't the best kind of horse. You know, and I think in our movement, we teach so much, like, you know, oh, learn by hearing, one who, you know, hears the scripture. And then he made a really nice point, which I won't be able to remember very clearly, but basically this idea that the lesson has run so deep in their person that it's in their marrow, that it's like when you see someone who has truly suffered and who's walked that path, you know, of like, I have been utterly humiliated by God, you know, this lesson has ravaged, you know, you can see it in their eyes, right? They're just a different type of thing. So that was really amazing. And yeah, the idea of Nishta failures. So I want to tie in my actual question, that these contradictions are sort of necessary for growth. And I had shared with you in our in my email a realization that had started dawning about, in particular with reference to contradictory statement, or maybe not contradiction, but controversial or just unpleasant or otherwise dualistic, right, statements by the leadership in our movement. And my take on that, I was realizing, was, you know, these are necessary in order to have a dialectic, right? It's like you have to kind of take a stance. It's like Kurukshetra, the basic idea is like pick a side. It doesn't, in a sense, it kind of doesn't matter what side you're on. You know, and this we learn by Bhishma, like he is that example, that you just pick a side and then offer it to Krishna, right? And, you know, be able to transcend the moral justification of the side that you're on. Because if you get fixed in that, you won't be able to learn, you know, and the whip will have to keep, you know, digging deeper, in a sense, so to speak. So yeah, it's like, okay, these different statements are being made, and I was speaking with a friend about this because he's really disturbed about something that a Swami had written, you know, years ago. And he's like, I can't really get over, you know. And it's like, well, even Prabhupada made contradictory statements sometimes within the same purport, you know, like say one thing and then, you know, saying, so it's like we have to kind of zoom out, and that even if our leaders are still on like the first step of like pick a side, like make a stance, like make a claim, you know, and haven't yet got to the second stage of, you know, now transcend that and understand the other side, like understand the bigger picture, right? We can still appreciate that what they're doing is they're making an offering to Krishna. They're saying, this is, I've chosen this side because I think this is the moral correct thing to do. And basically, I'm asking for your mercy. I'm asking you to accept this offering. And yeah, like tying in with the tears, it's like allow those tears to come, like allow the purification, allow the catharsis of whatever being on this side means, you know. So I hope that idea is clear. It's like there's a collective, like our collective consciousness is having this dialogue, this conversation, like, and we have to present every angle. It's like we won't be satisfied unless someone takes the stance of, you know, well, this, but what about this, you know? And so it's kind of up to the individual to appreciate these things and to not get locked into this very opinionated, you know, it no, it, Swami said like this, so it has to be like this. Because then you'll run into someone else, another devotee, and they'll say, well, I disagree with that. And what are you going to do? Like shoot them with arrows, you know? So if you could, thank you for bearing my long-windedness, but if you could speak something on this and how we can carry forward perhaps the conversation and understanding that bigger picture.
Okay. Thank you, Balaram Shakti. And you say a few things before even the question. Interesting points. For example, we're talking about perfection and imperfection, and a few things that I recall my meeting with Richard Rohr somehow. I remember he told me, like, real perfection must include imperfection, right? If perfection is not able to include imperfection, it's not perfection. So real perfection must include, must be able, willing and able to include imperfection. And you were talking about humiliation as well, and I remember him saying many times that he prays for one humiliation per day, at least. To keep him sober, so to say, to receive one good humiliation per day, so to keep him on the track, so to say, of sobriety and contact with reality. Again, not from a place of masochism, not from a place of self-loathing, but just a real healthy humiliation to show where I am, my lackings, my necessities, my limitations, and to invite me to be more dependent, more connected. No? And again, humiliation doesn't mean that someone else will be humiliating me. It's just me witnessing my own mess. And it's okay. And we need to be confronted with that in a healthy way without over-identifying with that. So that on one side, and in connection to contradictions, and you somehow elaborated the topic. So, and I agree with what you mentioned. There are stages in the journey in life. One second, I'll close the window because there are mold in the grass here. Okay. So there are different set of instructions for different stages, right? There are different lenses to look at reality from different parts of life. Sometimes you have this depiction of first half of life, second half of life. Jung will speak about that as well. So in certain stages, we are building a container, so to say, building a persona, a sense of being. And in other stages, we will be filling the container. So it's a very different situation. So in the beginning, sometimes the building of the container implies some particular parameters, which may be more emphasizes in other stages. In other stages, the emphasis will be filling the container. In the beginning, it's like, okay, let's make the container. What is the container made of? And this is the container. Not so much about filling, but just creating the structure and the boundaries. And in the context of that, we may be speaking in terms a little bit more black and white terms, a little bit more us and them terms, a little bit more, how to say, with less and less. With little space for paradox and contradiction or controversial things and whatever. Everything is more like, okay, this is it. And there is place for that. That's why Bhakti Thakur will say, There will be an eternal conflict between Kanishta and Madhyama Adhikari, he says. Because Kanishta Adhikaris means, Kanishta means something who is somehow neophyte in the practice. And they need very clear marked boundaries. And many times it will be more sectarian, if you will, fanatical. And there is a place for that in certain stage. And they need clearly demarked spaces. And Madhyam will be more nuanced, more progressive, more advanced. So for him or her, those boundaries are suffocating. But for the kindergarten neophyte, those are giving him, her an identity. And for the other person, those same boundaries are preventing the further identity that needs to blossom. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur said the two of them will be in conflict. The Madhyama Adhikari will understand the Kanishta Adhikari, but probably the Kanishta Adhikari won't understand the Madhyama Adhikari. And in that sense, there will be in different pages. And that will happen always. There will be always someone in one stage, there will be always someone in another. And that's a complexity. And that's why ideally spiritual instruction at the end of the day has to have some personalized way of transmission and not just the book or the class for 3,000 people, because the 3,000 people are in different stages. And of course, one can say something absolute. One can speak about love and God and the soul, and everyone will hopefully receive their lesson if they are sincere. But at the same time, there is a need for a more individual specific carving of each particular case. And that's why it's important to have also a person-to-person connection. And that's where you can understand the different instructions that one same teacher says, as you mentioned, and seems to be contradictory, not only things that Srila Prabhupada may have said, but other acharyas. Like I try to make some sense of that in my first book, in the second part of my first book, showing things that our acharyas say on one particular topic, and they say different things. Not only different acharyas say different things, but the same acharyas say different things. So how to understand that? So again, I think under establishing this idea of different stages is a way to appreciate that, no? To appreciate the personal sensibility of each teacher addressing every particular case. Now, like for example, we quoted the Bhagavad Gita a few minutes ago. So Krishna speaks the Bhagavad Gita to Arjuna in a certain way. Then we go to the Srimad Bhagavatam, and in the 11th canto we find the Uddhava Gita, which is basically the Bhagavad Gita retold to Uddhava. Now, Uddhava is not Arjuna, right? Uddhava is not a Kshatriya. He's in a very different situation. So the message is the same, basically, but slightly different considering Uddhava's disposition. Or like Srila Siddhar Maharaj will say, if Krishna told to Arjuna to fight or to act however he will like at the end of the Gita, right? I have given you these instructions, now you deliver it and act accordingly. And Arjuna chose to fight. Srila Siddhar Maharaj will say, if Krishna will have said that to Uddhava, Uddhava will have left the battlefield because his nature was different. And that was okay for him. You follow my point? So that's also interesting. Not only different instructions to different people, but the same instruction and different people reacting differently, and all of them being correct, depending as long as they are acting according to the Adhikar. Again, we are going back to the first question, no? To their Adhikar, to their acquired nature, to their mood, to their psyche, to everything put together, Arjuna will fight, Uddhava will leave the battlefield. Both of them are equally perfect in their own way of behaving. Yugal Kishore is mentioning different dharma. Yeah, if we take dharma from that place, yeah. There are different ways of understanding the term dharma or duty, but yeah, one way we could say, yeah. As a kshatriya, you have a dharma, but the duty is dictated by the nature you have. Again, there is a nature. That's why Krishna is telling at one point to Arjuna, because at one point Arjuna threatens to leave the battlefield, right? So he says, it will be, I would prefer to leave all that. And the implication, the commentator says, that Krishna says at one point, is like, even if you leave the battlefield out of cowardice or whatever the reason, evasiveness, your very nature of a kshatriya will bring you back to the battlefield. You won't be able to resist because you are a warrior. So your nature will bring you back. So even if you will be leaving, and you will be brought back by force against your wish. So better participate in war voluntarily, not by force of circumstance. That's even better. So that's Arjuna's situation again. But for someone like Uddhava, it's like, okay, I walk off this battlefield and I enter into a cave and absorb myself in meditation. And that was perfect for Uddhava. So again, at the end of the day, we find that it all boils down, as I like to say, to radical personalism, in the sense of we have to address every specific case and situation. And in some particular case, some instruction seems contradictory. We have to take the instruction specifically. What's the context? What's being said? What has been said in other parts? Maybe this has been said to someone in particular. Or maybe in some cases, as I also concluded in my first book, we may think and propose some possibilities why this was said here, why this was said there. But maybe at the end of the day, we say, I don't know. If you ask me, why, I don't know, Srila Prabhupada said that nobody falls from Vaikuntha, but he also said that we fall from Vaikuntha. Why he say that? I can tell you my hypothesis, but I don't know. And I'm okay. I mean, I'm okay with not knowing why he say that, but at the same time, I know, or I think I know, what's the actual Siddhanta on that topic, right? So I will do my study, my research, what's the actual conclusion of that particular theme. And okay, whenever he's alive with that, I align with that. And whenever he says something else, I will try to understand and explain why he may have said that, even if I, at the end of the day, I will say, I don't know which was the ultimate reason. And I coexist with that mystery without, for me, Prabhupada becoming someone less because of that. So yeah, at one point we have to, of course, we are invited to solve contradictions. We're invited to reconcile apparent inconsistencies in Shastra or in the statements of our teachers. We're invited not to be lazy in that sense, not to press the achintya button, as sometimes we say it. Now, when something goes beyond your grasp, oh, it's inconceivable. Next topic. No. You try to use your brain, to think as much as you can, to use your faculties, your discernment, and so on, to contextualize situations, to try to be empathic, to enter into the shoes of the other person, again, to be sensitive in which particular time that person was, which was the zeitgeist, what was the audience he was facing, no? What was the psychology that was prevalent in that particular culture? I mean, all those things are playing a role in the way a particular teacher says something at some people in any given moment. So if we do not do that exercise and we are just judging whatever, what Prabhupada says 70 years ago from our comfort zone in 2024 without traveling back in time and being properly empathic, that can be dangerous. The conclusion we may reach may be dangerous, will be insensitive. And again, even if after doing all that exercise, there's something that remains mystery, okay, that's a legal mystery. That's a mystery that remains after us having trying to do our part as better as we can. That's my point. It's not that we are lazy and say, that's mystery, that's achintya. No, I try to reconcile, I try to integrate, I try to understand, to be empathic. All these type of disciplines, it's a discipline to your mind. And even after all that, something remains, how to say in English, inscrutable, no? Impossible to understand. Okay, I have to coexist with that mystery for the rest of my life. That's a type of adhikar we have to develop also. Now, we shouldn't get too nervous about something remaining uncertain on some level. Again, there are many things that are very certain, very clear, very evident, that are blessing us. So we should embrace that fully and allow some little things. Again, I'm not saying something too big because that may be too much, to remain a mystery, to remain something that we cannot solve. At least we cannot solve in the way we try to solve things. That's the thing. No, our method of solving stuff is generally very, how to say, overtly masculine, so to say, like conquering, like colonizing the questions, you know, and getting the answer certainty. Okay, I have it clear. It's my new prize now. Next question now. And sometimes you have just to coexist with the question. You know, as I also mentioned, radical personalism, quoting this poet Rilke, he will say, you have to live with the question enough till it becomes an answer. Sometimes we are very anxious to get answers. We are not very willing to coexist with the question and allow the question to remain a question for all the time it needs to be, for all the time it needs to be mystery, uncertainty. And gradually that will manifest as an answer. But that answer is, in one sense, it also invites us, it's a bridge to a further question. No? We should be okay with questions, with disclosure, not closure, 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 closure. That doesn't leave the field open, so to say. So as I understand that some contradictions can affect our faith and disturb us, and I totally understand that we need to solve them and we need clarity and we need proper philosophical thinking or proper research and explanation, there's also a place to not become addicted to certainty and leaving some space for mystery and uncertainty and unsolved things, trusting that in time everything will find its place as long as we had the proper orientation, the proper patience. No? As I like to define patience, like waiting, coexisting with mystery, waiting, coexisting with those things we cannot control, and at the same time trusting that. I'm coexisting with something that I was not able to figure out, to solve, to understand. It remains a mystery, but I trust that. And I'm patient and I'm waiting while trusting. It's not that I'm waiting while freaking out. I'm waiting while trusting. I'm trusting the unfolding of the mystery. I'm not feeling that that will be a monster that is will devour me completely, but trusting that unfolding. Anyhow, that's what came today. I hope that helps. Balaram Shakti, thank you so much. And so far, I see one hand raised by Martina. I saw one hand raised before, but somehow it disappeared. I don't remember who was. So let's go to Martina. You can unmute yourself, Martina.
Yes, great. Thank you, Maharaj.
Nice to
I'm
see you.
outside. Nice to see you too. I'm happy that
Belgium?
I'm in Belgium. In
Okay.
Belgium at the moment. Yes. So I'm glad that you will be able to take my question. So basically it's about deity worship. You are aware that I have certain deities at my home for quite some time already. And let's say that I had very nice dynamics with those deities, very sweet dynamics, until I kind of raised my standards because I was thinking, okay, this, and you know, I was reading and hearing that certain deities need to be worshipped in certain ways. So I raised the standards and then I kind of lost everything, like everything what I had before. And yeah, I feel really, I don't know, that I'm like somewhere in the middle. And I was really praying and asking Krishna, like, please guide me how to move forward with this, because you know, I don't want to go into the direction that I'm saying that certain rules and regulations should not be there, or that we should not follow them. But at the same time, I guess I'm not there yet, you know. Basically, the question would be like, what to do when this happens, and something like this happens, because I really felt connection with Krishna. And you know, when I introduced something that I heard that I should introduce, and maybe it didn't come to me naturally, I immediately lost it. But at the same time, I'm thinking, how much can I trust myself and, you know, allow myself to just perform whatever I feel? Because I know, for example, with chanting, when I started chanting, I didn't feel anything, right? So I was just chanting, you know, just kind of mechanically. But then with some time, I started to feel something. So I'm also thinking, okay, maybe should I just continue performing, even though I don't feel anything, even though I'm like completely lost? Or should I drop it and should I just go where I was before? So yeah, I would appreciate your thoughts on that.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. And of course, I'm sharing some thoughts on the basis of what you have just shared. Probably there are always more details that I may not be aware of. So you let me know if I'm missing something or skipping something or something that I'm saying is missing the mark. But yeah, the situation you describe is familiar in one sense, in the sense of I've heard many times devotees like beginning, whether it's to worship the deity or some other thing, some other service that begins in a very like simple way, intimate way, sweet, so to say, without much idea of, without much pressure in terms of doing it perfectly and raising the standard and the different ways of doing and public opinion and so on and so forth. It was more like personal service between pujari, the devotee, and the deity. It was more concentrated on the heart, if you will. And sometimes, and I'm again, I don't want to say that all that I'm saying applies to your situation. I'm just sharing in general. But sometimes I've seen that it starts from that heart simplicity and intimacy and sweetness. And somehow or other, again, sometimes by influence of the environment, it starts to become more a head issue, like trying to fit in with the norms and the standards of what other people say. And no, this is not correct. You have to do it like that because it is offensive, and you have to raise the standard, and you have to do like, and it starts to become more a concern of doing every single step and rule perfectly instead of a more hard connection with God in that particular form. So I will personally advise to somehow to simplify things in a way that is not laziness. No, it's not that I'm simplifying, so I have to avoid doing all this stuff, but just from which place I'm doing the stuff. Always, always with the motivation, like, okay, you have to raise the standard and do all the things, but the question is why you are doing all that? Because someone told me, because it's the right thing to do, not so much because I want to please Krishna, because I feel inspired to offer this for his pleasure. It's more about many times. Now, I'm not saying it's all your case, but many times it's more
No,
about,
it is.
okay, then
Yeah.
perfect. It applies.
Yeah.
And again, you are not alone in that. Again, it happens in so many ways and cases. So many times, and especially again, social pressure, and especially with the deity, that happens a lot. Because, and it's so funny because there are so many standards of worshiping the deity. You know, sometimes devotees enter into this place where someone is worshiping the deity in one way, and you learn it another way, and you have your idea of this is the only way possible, blessed, legal to do it, and you start to tell others how wrong they are doing or how more complicated it could become. I mean, like you're doing your worship in this way, but it can get really more complicated, and you should be doing that way because the more complicated, the better. Somehow that seems to be the ethic, which in one sense doesn't make sense, right? Right? It's not like the more, I don't know, mudras and rules and bathings per day and offerings and numbers and anyhow, I know the devotees who become basically neurotic about that. are just absorbable how many rounds of incense they are making, because if they miss one round, they think I'm going to hell. And if I put the finger wrong in the mudra, that will be offense. And it's all about the potential to fail at every single moment. And you are basically paralyzed about not making the wrong thing, not making the wrong thing, not making the wrong thing. And your head is prominent there and the heart is somewhere else. So when that's happening, I will say, yeah, it's time to simplify. But to simplify externally, so the internal offering can become more elaborate. So it's not evasiveness, it's not escapism. It's not like, oh, you're being lazy. Now you have, how to say, watered down the standard. No, I'm just simplifying enough so I can be fully present and absorbed and offering my heart the best possible way I can, because that's what Archana is about ultimately. So that's what I will say. You know, the other day I was listening to a conversation from one disciple of Srila Siddhar Maharaj, and once, and again, there are different standards, but this devotee wanted to worship deities and went to Srila Siddhar Maharaj, and he gave him a Govardhan Shila. So the devotee became all frightened and started to freak out. Again, all these things of fear and, oh, and Govardhan Shila and what to do, how to do it without going to hell. And it's like, oh my, and Srila Siddhar Maharaj was kind of like watching him, like, what's going on here? No, like, and he then immediately starts to become all nervous, like, so how to worship all the things that I have to do? And full of anxiety, basically. Now, instead of feeling, wow, I'm receiving such a blessing and mercy and have celebrating, it feels like the worst curse on earth. So Srila is looking at him like, so he's like, so what to do? What's the standard? And he says, you can have it the altar, and you can offer whatever you cook to him. And that was it. And the devotees start to get in anxiety because it was too simple. Right? He got like, so what else? All the complexity, all the performance, all the, you know, all the fancy stuff. No, you just offer the whatever you like, implying do it simple and the rest offer your heart to. Like Mahaprabhu giving Govardhan to Raghunath Das Goswami. No? Again, it's Raghunath Das Goswami, but basically he gave Govardhan Shila, he gave Gunja Mala. And you told him, you just offer to him, put tulsi, offer some Ganga water. And that's it. To Raghunath Das Goswami, the Acharya of Prayojan. Again, I'm not saying this to say everyone worshiping the deity has to do like that, or if you're offering something more elaborate from a healthy place, oh, I have to simplify it. No, not necessarily. But the point is, standards are there to facilitate a particular absorption. Smartabhyasatatam says the scripture. Sarvi, all rules and regulations, all those do's and don'ts are to serve this unique rule. Always remember Krishna, never forget Krishna. So the idea is, whatever helps you to become more present to God's presence, that's the rule to follow. Whatever gets in the way of that, that's the don't. That's how we can develop a criteria. Now, we have to, at the end of the day, to have some common sense. So that's what I will suggest, no? Like, to whether it's worshiping the deity or any other service we do, let's do it in a way that is sustainable enough and done in such a way that we can really focus our presence and our heart in that moment in a devotional, favorable service, and we don't get stuck in our mind, head, just calculating, trying to be perfect and being afraid about all the possible mistakes we may be making, and losing what the actual situation is about. So that's what I will say. Don't get like overcomplicated, and there will be always people saying, you should add this, and you could do more offerings, and you should dress them in this way, and you have to get more dressed, and you have to get, like we were talking some months, weeks ago with Sumati, You have to get what? Six showers a day was? Six showers a day. And I was like, why six showers a day? And because, okay, I heard, okay, you have to get shower when you go to the bathroom, when you eat. But even if you haven't gone to the bathroom nor eaten, still you have to have six showers a day. And it's like, why? No? So this obsession with maybe with external purity, but again, it becomes something very externally oriented. No, it has not, and when you, and when the problem is that when you get to follow up those rules perfectly, then you think, I don't need to offer my heart. You forgot about that because you are completely convinced you are doing everything perfectly. Going back to the beginning of our conversation on this performance and this perfection, I'm having my six showers per day, I'm doing all my mudras, not missing one finger. I missed one finger just one moment ago. And I'm doing my five Raj Boga offerings. I'm not failing, but you forget to offer your heart. And Krishna is still waiting. The offering has not come yet. When is the offering coming? I'm so hungry for bhakti. No? This guy is so neurotic, paranoid with following all rules and everything, but he keeps his heart locked in a vault there. And I'm so hungry here for some bhakti, for some heart. So you ultimately, Archana boils down to that. So I will say that, no, according to your situation. And again, Srila Maharaj will tell this devotee, he will say, oh, but sometimes I have to travel. So how to keep Giriraj, what to do? And he said, oh, put him to rest at home and do your travels. And when you return, you serve him. Like common sense, right? Which is not so common many times. That's what we call it, uncommon sense. So yeah, you have to phalena pariccheti, you have to judge the tree by its fruits. Yeah, on some level you have to trust your own experience. Of course, we are not enlightened beings, and we have to keep a watch about some inner movements that are not very realistic, so to say. But also we have to trust our moments of deepest honesty and sincerity, trusting that also Krishna will shed light at those moments, and he will help us to clearly see what to do, how to do. So that's what comes in this moment. I don't know if it somehow hits the aim or misses the mark completely, something that helps.
No, it really helps. Thanks so much. Yeah, you got it right. I was really at that place. I kind of feel that Krishna is there, but I'm not there anymore, so I cannot find him because I'm approaching from, angles that I don't feel like actually doing that, all of that. So,
Yeah. Again, so we have keep it as simple as it allows you to be there, no? So that's kind of the criteria, no? Keep it, follow rules and regulations or standards as long as they facilitate your presence to him, to them, and vice versa. When that starts to get in the way, that means we are missing the actual intention of those rules and standards. So if the rule and standard is helping me, I embrace it. If it's not helping me, I may need to re-understand the rule, or in some cases, I may not need to follow all those rules, because again, there are endless rules, but all those rules are to, there is a purpose to the rule, no? So just following the rule doesn't complete the whole thing. The rules is just something to help to trigger proper connection and presence and inspiration. So yeah, I'm following just a bunch of rules doesn't equal pleasing Krishna. Rupa Goswami said that can be niyama graha, that can be just following rules. Krishna is never saying, I'm just pleased by following rules. I want your heart. So, yeah.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for your question. Thank you. Okay, so I think we are done and we have reached our normal 1.5 hours. So we'll be concluding here today. And yeah. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu ki jai, Sri Harinam Prabhu ki jai. Shri Shri Gonitinanda Gaur Gadadhara ju ki jai, Shri Shri Radha Madan Mohan Radha Govinda Dev Radha Gopinath ju ki jai, Gaur Bhakta Vrinda ki jai, Gaur Premanand Hari Bol, Panchakalpa Taru Vishcha Kripa.